Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Today's show is Hijacking Catastrophe, the Legacy of 911. The more things change, the more things remain the same. Later in the show, actor Wallace Shawn and playwright Andrea Gregory read a passage from the Melian Dialogue, a timeless examination of the rights of states by Thucydides. But first,
we have Ray McGovern with us. Ray served as the CIA analyst for 27 years and is with the steering group of veteran intelligence professionals. And as this fifth anniversary of 9/11 and with the midterm election just 2 months away, McGovern is going to actually talk to us now about how the president succeeded in hijacking catastrophe, making a silk purse out of a sow's ear of torture, and why we're knee-deep in the big muddy and the big fool says to push on and on and on from Afghanistan to Iraq to Iran. How do you assess it? What are your thoughts?
It's incredibly sad that out of that tragedy in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania was born another tragedy. We have a first-class tragedy on our hands now, because of the incredibly cynical way that the Bush administration exploited your trauma and mine, I'm a New Yorker as well, to justify a war of aggression. We know now from what the Senate Intelligence Committee, dominated as all committees are these days by Republicans, we know that that committee, after 2.5 years of investigation, has found that there was no tie between Iraq and what happened on 9/11, despite the president's successful propaganda campaign to connect the two, so much so that when we invaded Iraq, 69% of the Americans believed the lie that Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. This is really unconscionable. And what it led to is the kind of things that you mentioned. We have here a classic example of what Nuremberg defined as a war of aggression. And what Nuremberg said, and I quote, "To initiate a war of aggression is to perpetrate the most significant war crime, because this particular war crime contains within it the accumulated evil of all war crimes." And when you look at what the accumulated evil might be, think torture, folks, think kidnapping, think putting people in black prison holes and not even telling their families or the Red Cross. Think about wiretapping, eavesdropping on Americans without the warrants required by law. Think about all those things, and they flow directly from the most significant international crime, namely starting a war of aggression. Why is this relevant today? Well, it shouldn't be relevant at all, because there was no connection. And now we have the Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee agreeing that there was no reason for Don Rumsfeld, for example, to say that the evidence of a connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq was, quote, bulletproof, quote, a bald lie. The president himself said many things to insinuate, or even more insinuate, that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. And so this was the catalyst. This was the event that allowed the president's men to perpetrate a war of aggression. And that's very sad.
Ray, you had mentioned the term war crimes and that you'll be delivering a verdict on war crimes to the president. Could you talk about that?
We have conducted an international inquiry to hear evidence given with respect to whether the president has committed crimes that rise to the level of a shock to humanity, crimes that could be legitimately called war crimes. Now, our judges have poured through the testimony and have come to a verdict. I don't know what that verdict is just yet, and we are going to have a major event. And what we hope to emphasize is that let's not have yet another war against Iran, because we greatly fear that the president is going to lay out the, quote, case, quote, end quote, against Iran.
Ray, what did we miss? You've been a CIA analyst for 27 years. You were part of the morning briefings of the presidential elite in so many ways. What is this all about? What is this war? Why are there even groups like Steering Group of Veteran Intelligence Professionals? What is the general public missing about the legacy of 9/11 that pushed us to Iraq?
Well, Mimi, those are really the $64 questions, aren't they? Suffice it to say that when the Bush regime came in with Cheney and Rumsfeld, appropriately now called the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal, they had their own agenda. And the agenda sprung from the notion that we're the only remaining superpower in the world. How many times have you heard that? The sole remaining superpower in the world. Well, their attitude was that since we have this status, we would be remiss if we didn't throw that weight around in key parts of the world to assert our influence and to grab hold of the strategic areas such as the Middle East, where, as everyone knows, most of the gas and oil are located. And so a very cynical plan was devised to attack Iraq first. Now, I hasten to emphasize this all happened before 9/11. At the very first National Security Council meeting on the 30th of January 2001, three-quarters of that meeting was devoted to how we get Saddam. Not should we get Saddam or why we should be worried about Saddam, but how we get him, okay? How do we know this? Paul O'Neill wrote a book about it. Paul O'Neill was there. Paul O'Neill was the Treasury Secretary at the time. So that's January. Now, when 9/11 came along in September, they had greased the skids, so to speak. They had sort of gotten out the maps as to which parts of Iraq would be sold to which oil companies. And when 9/11 happened, well, that was the catalyst. That made it all possible. They would instill this fear in the Americans that Saddam Hussein was somehow responsible for 9/11, play on that, as I said before, most cynically, deceive most of us, and get the support they needed, not only from us, but from our elected representatives, by how? By distorting the intelligence, by forging documents, by telling half-truths, and by connecting Saddam Hussein with 9/11. And I've been around in Washington for 43 years now since I left my native Bronx, and I have never, never seen such a cynical escapade that remotely resembles what they did, much less the fact that this happened to be the supreme international crime launching a war of aggression. So what we have now is a intelligence community that is really not worth anything anymore, and we have a president that doesn't even realize what he's missing. Because where is he going to go now? Where is he going to go if he wants to know, for example, what's going to happen in Iraq in the next 6 months? He's going to go to General Hayden in the CIA and expect an honest answer? Well, I suppose he doesn't really appreciate an honest answer, because Hayden's going to just tell him what he thinks the president wants to hear, and that was the case with his two predecessors, George Tenet and Porter Goss. And so the president, whether he realizes it or not, is deprived of a key tool toward the orderly making of foreign policy. The big questions are not able to be answered by what we used to have when I worked there, an objective, independent assessment directorate, which was able to tell the president what the score was without fear or favor. He'd come to us and say, suppose we bomb North Vietnam, will that make Ho Chi Minh quit? And we would say, no, sir, it wouldn't. Now, this points up another aspect of the problem. You know, we can tell the president exactly what we think and be right, but he's not obliged to follow intelligence advice, that's for sure. But in this case, he no longer even has any prayer of getting objective intelligence advice. They'll tell him what he wants to hear. The blue-suited generals work for the Air Force will tell the president we can bomb the hell out of the Iraqis, and now maybe the Iranians as well. And he and Cheney and Rumsfeld are likely to do this, and mark my words, in my view, there's an equal chance that they will do something like bombing Iran before the election. Why? Well, the president's numbers are way down. Something needs to be resurrected so that the president can seem to be a war hero again, or a war president, somebody who you should not elect the Democratic Congress to pull the rug out from under a president at war. And so I have a really, really strong fear that since the stakes are so high, look, if the, Democrats take the Congress in November, there will be impeachment proceedings. There will be investigations of all kinds. The president will have no authority or any power during the last 2 years of his regime. And not only that, but he's liable for prosecution under the War Crimes Act, which he violated, and the Supreme Court has ruled on that. He's liable for prosecution under the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and a district court judge has ruled on that. And he has, when he leaves his term, he has criminal responsibility for these things. So something in the nature of a deus ex machina, something really, really strong has to be adduced. And I do not put it past people like Rove and Cheney and the president getting together and saying, we can follow the suggestions of these blue-suited generals who say that we can fly these stealth bombers over Iran and really just take that out, take out all these sites. And if we don't get them all, we'll just warn Iran that the next ones might have nukes, and we'll scare the hell out of them, and we'll be war presidents again, and we'll keep the House and the Senate. This is very contrived, but it's my major fear in these next 2 months, and the bottom line is we've got to get out and make sure that the right people get elected in these next 2 months so that if the president doesn't bring off something like this, then he'll be constrained for the next 2 years.
And lastly, and then we have a piece of sound that I want you to set up for us. We only have about a minute to listen, and that is the whole question of torture. Now, it is clear that the definition of torture that the U.S. has and is trying to institutionalize in many ways through legislation, as far as I'm concerned, and any humane or rational person, it is torture. But your own perspective on Bush's official authorization of torture.
He was given very bad legal advice by the vice president's lawyer and by his own lawyer, Gonzalez. This was in January of 2002. He was told that he could disregard the Geneva Conventions, exempt the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from the Geneva protections, and that he could pretty much do what he wanted that was, quote, humane, but also consistent with military necessity. Now, that was the president on the 7th of February issuing an order that said we will treat these folks humanely, as appropriate, and as consistent with military necessity. Now, that language shows that military necessity trumps humanely, okay? And that led to the abuses in Abu Ghraib. It led to the president becoming, in my view, a war criminal because he authorized this torture. It led to the loophole through which Rumsfeld and Cheney drove the Mack truck of officially sanctioned torture. And I have to say, this is one of the darkest moments in our nation's history.
Well, Ray McGovern, we actually know that you've attracted widespread attention when you publicly confronted Donald Rumsfeld about his claims concerning weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So we actually pulled down some of that sound and are going to play it for our listeners now.
I would like to compliment you on your observation that lies are fundamentally destructive of the trust that government needs to govern. A colleague of mine, Paul Pillar, who is the top agency analyst on the Middle East and on counterterrorism, accused you and your colleagues of an organized campaign of manipulation, quote, I suppose by some definitions
could you get to your question,
that be
please?
Called a lie. Atlanta, September 27, 2002, Donald Rumsfeld said, and I quote, there is bulletproof evidence of links between Al-Qaeda and the government of President Saddam Hussein. Was that a lie, Mr. Rumsfeld, or was that manufactured somewhere else? Because all of my CIA colleagues disputed that, and so did the 9/11 Commission. And so I would like to ask you to be upfront with the American people. Why did you lie to get us into a war that was not necessary and that has caused these kinds of casualties? Yeah. Why?
Well, first of all, I haven't lied. I did not lie then. Colin Powell didn't lie. He spent weeks and weeks with the Central Intelligence Agency people and prepared a presentation that I know he believed was accurate. And he presented that to the United Nations. The president spent weeks and weeks with the Central Intelligence people. And he went to the American people and made a presentation. I'm not in the intelligence business. They gave the world their honest opinion. It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and
we
were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and northeast, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
My words were that... No. Wait a minute. Let him stay 1 second. Just a second.
This is America, huh?
Yeah. You're getting plenty of play, sir.
I just like an honest answer.
I'm giving it to you.
We're talking about lies and your allegation that there was bulletproof evidence of ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. Was that a lie, or were you misled?
Zarqawi was in Baghdad during the pre-war period. That is a fact.
Zarqawi? He was in the north of Iraq in a place where Saddam Hussein had no rule.
He was also in Baghdad.
Yeah, when he needed to go to the hospital. Come on, these people aren't idiots. They know the story.
You are... Let me give you an example. It's easy for you to make a charge... But why do you think that the men and women in uniform, every day when they came out of Kuwait and went into Iraq, put on chemical weapon protective suits? Because they liked the style? They honestly believed that there were chemical weapons. Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons on his own people previously. He'd used them on his neighbor, the Iranians. And they believed he had those weapons. We believed he had those weapons.
That's what we call a non sequitur. It doesn't matter what the troops believe. It matters what you believe.
I think, Mr. Secretary, the debate is over. We have other questions, courtesy to the audience.
And you were listening to CIA analyst of 27 years and now with an organization of veteran intelligence professionals who thinks the president should be indicted for war crimes, and that is Ray McGovern. So we're going to move on right now, and we're going to listen to Wallace Shawn and Andre Gregory.
Why do you think Bush is so eager to invade Iraq? And why are he and his people so sure they're right?
Well, while a large part of it could be that they believe that Saudi Arabian oil is looking very shaky, very vulnerable, a revolution in Saudi Arabia could leave the United States in a bad position in regard to oil. And so they want to have Iraqi oil under their own firm control as insurance.
That's very plausible. People keep saying about Bush's urge toward war, why now? Nothing's changed in Iraq. But maybe the change isn't in Iraq. Your explanation would also clarify the incredible self-confidence of these people.
Yes. Bush knows he doesn't know much about the world or the country. About the world, other countries, or history. But he and his friends know a lot about oil.
Psychologically, Rumsfeld and Bush and all those people are tapping into an ancient imperial mode of feeling. That deep, insatiable drive to dominate, that enormous, almost sensual love of power for its own sake. It all reminds me of the Melian dialogue. That's why I've been carrying my copy of Thucydides around with me recently.
Really?
Yes. Debbie read that section out loud to me many years ago, And now it seems so apropos once again. It's about an invasion, and it sort of presents in such a direct form what powerful leaders so often really are feeling. You know, they talk about the danger of Saddam Hussein's weapons or whatever, but when you look at them talking, you know they're loving it. They're loving the moment. There's a pure exaltation in being able to make others do one's will. And in the dialogue, the ones who are being invaded, the Melians, say some rather clever things in response as well.
Well, let's read some of it for our audience then.
Good. You can read the Athenians. I'll read the Melians. As you'll recall, the Athenians had become rulers of a large empire, and Melos was a small island. Before doing any harm to the land, the Athenian generals sent representatives to negotiate. The Melians said, "No one could object to each of us putting forward our views in a calm atmosphere. What's scarcely consistent with such a proposal is the threat, indeed the certainty, of your making war on us. We see that the likely end of it all will be either war if we prove that we're in the right and so refuse to surrender, or else slavery."
If you're going to spend time in enumerating your suspicions about the future, or if you've met here for any reason except to look the facts in the face, and on the basis of these facts, consider how you can save your city from destruction, there's no point in going on with the discussion. If, however, you'll do as we suggest, then we'll speak on. We, on our side, will use no fine phrases saying, for example, that we have a right to our empire because we defeated the Persians, or that we have come up against you now because of the injuries you've done us. A great mass of words that nobody would believe. And we ask you on your side not to imagine that you'll influence us by saying that you've never done us any harm. Instead, we recommend that you should try to get what it's possible for you to get, taking into consideration what we both really do think. Since you know as well as we do that when these matters are discussed by practical people, the standard of justice depends on the power to compel, and that in fact the strong do what they have the power to do, and the weak accept what they have to accept.
Then, in our view, it's at any rate useful that you shouldn't destroy a principle that's to the general good of all men, namely, that in the case of all who fall into danger, there should be such a thing as fair play and just dealing. And this is a principle which affects you as much as anybody, since your own fall would be visited by the most terrible vengeance.
One is not so much frightened of being conquered by a power which rules over others as of what would happen if a ruling power is attacked and defeated by its own subjects. So far as this point is concerned, you can leave us to face the risks involved. We don't want any trouble in bringing you into our empire, and we want you to be spared for the good both of yourselves and of ourselves.
How could it be just as good for us to be the slaves as for you to be the masters?
Well, you, by giving in, would save yourselves from disaster. We, by not destroying you, would be able to profit from you.
So you wouldn't agree to our being neutral, friends instead of enemies, but allies of neither side?
No. Because it's not your hostility that injures us. It's rather the case that if we were on friendly terms with you, our subjects would regard that as a sign of weakness in us, whereas your hatred is evidence of our power.
But do you think there's no security for you in what we suggest? Is it not certain that you'll make enemies of all states who are at present neutral when they see what's happening here and naturally conclude that in the course of time you'll attack them too? Doesn't this mean that you're strengthening the enemies you have already? and forcing others to become your enemies, even against their intentions and their inclinations? We know that in war, fortune sometimes makes the odds more level than could be expected from the difference in numbers of the two sides. It's difficult, and you may be sure that we know it, for us to oppose your power and fortune. Nevertheless, we trust that the gods will give us fortune as good as yours, because we're standing for what's right against what's wrong.
So far as the favor of the gods is concerned, we think we have as much right to that as you have. Our opinion of the gods and our knowledge of men lead us to conclude that it's a general and necessary law of nature to rule whatever one can. This is not a law that we made ourselves, nor were we the first to act on it. We found it already in existence, and we'll leave it to exist forever among those who come after us. My God. So what finally happened?
Well, according to Thucydides, the Melians made some minor attempts at resistance, but finally surrendered unconditionally. Then the Athenians put to death all the men of military age and sold the women and children as slaves.
Wow.
It makes you realize what we're up against in dealing with the psychology of our current leaders.
Wallace Shawn and Andre Gregory.
Passage from the Melian Dialogue by Thucydides. And this has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.